From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we talk about acting and hard times with Danny Aiello. He played the pizzeria owner in Do the Right Thing and shares Intended in Moonstruck. His movie Ruby just came out on video. It's about Jack Ruby, the man who shot Kennedy's assassin. Also, actor Charles Dutton. He stars in the TV show Rock on the Fox Network. It soon returns with a series of live episodes. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Mo Money, the new comedy starring Damon Wayans. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. A new team of United Nations inspectors is on its way to Baghdad to search for more details on the Iraqi weapons program. The team that will enter the agriculture ministry includes no Americans, as demanded by Iraq in return for allowing the UN to search the building. The BBC's Simon Ingram reports.
The task facing the six-man inspection team is to locate any documents or other evidence concealed in the ministry concerning Iraq's pre-war arms procurement or manufacturing programs. Assuming there was ever such incriminating material kept there, and the Iraqis have always denied as much, there can be little doubt that it will have been spirited away or destroyed during the long standoff that began on July the 5th, when the team made their first abortive attempt to carry out a search. The inspectors kept up a round-the-clock vigil outside the building to try and prevent that happening, but were forced to retreat last Wednesday when street protests threatened their safety. The possibility of further demonstrations tomorrow cannot be ruled out. The state-controlled media, far from acknowledging that the leadership made concessions to the UN, has presented the compromise as a victory.
The BBC's Simon Ingram. Despite the apparent settlement of the weapons inspection standoff, defense officials said today that the United States is building up its military presence in the Persian Gulf. Speaking on condition of anonymity, the officials said that the United States has sent a third aircraft carrier to the Gulf and will hold war games with Kuwait next week. They said the carrier John F. Kennedy left for the Mediterranean today after cutting short a port visit in the Virgin Islands so quickly that 50 crewmen were left behind. The officials also said that the Pentagon was sending 8 batteries of Patriot anti-aircraft missiles to Kuwait. In South Africa today, a pathologist received anonymous death threats after his weekend allegations that police have beaten, tortured, and killed scores of people held in their custody, including some who died just this month. NPR's Ann Cooper reports from Johannesburg.
Yesterday's accusations from independent pathologist Jonathan Gluckman set off a political firestorm here. The law and order minister said he's asked police to file a full response to the charges, but he said it is clearly not correct to blame all deaths in custody on the police. The government's chief pathologist spoke up in defense of police. He said his autopsies have never found any evidence to support allegations of police murder of detainees. But the African National Congress, which cut off political talks after alleging that the white government is guilty of violence against blacks, today said that Dr. Gluckman's charges confirm that South African police hold themselves above the law. I'm Ann Cooper in Johannesburg.
The Dow Industrials lost 4 points today. This is NPR. Vice President Dan Quayle said today that the debate about keeping him on the Republican ticket is a closed issue. During a campaign stop in Cincinnati, Quayle said that he'll stay on as the president's running mate and work to take the president's case to the American people. The vice president went on to Chicago, where the Chicago Tribune has called for him to step down. Quayle noted that the Tribune has made wrong calls before, including the famous headline that asserted Dewey beats Truman. A group of Republican women who support abortion rights today announced their plans to launch a caravan campaign across the country to urge party leaders to change the GOP's platform language on abortion. NPR's Richard Gonzalez reports.
The Republican women say their party has been taken over by the anti-abortion minority and that the issue is hurting the party because it discourages pro-choice Republicans from being active. Mary Dent Crisp is the chairwoman of the National Republican Coalition for Choice.
Choice is the very heart of democracy, And without choice, there is no freedom. Anti-choice is anti-Republican, anti-American, and anti-choice is losing politics. It is bad politics.
The pro-choice Republican women say party leaders have resisted moves to allow convention delegates to vote on the abortion platform language. Their caravan promoting a pro-choice platform will stop in Louisville, Indianapolis, St. Louis, Wichita, Oklahoma City, Dallas, and Austin before arriving in Houston for the Republican convention. I'm Richard Gonzalez in Washington.
House Minority Whip Newt Gingrich says it's a waste of time and taxpayers' money, but Georgia election officials have ordered a recount of the Republican primary that Gingrich won by fewer than 1,000 votes. Gingrich's opponent, Herman Clark, asked for the recount late last week. He cited reports of voting irregularities. The Georgia Supervisor of Elections said that the recount will determine if the arithmetic was correct on election night and will not address allegations of ballot irregularities. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Sometimes a movie opens that you think is really special, yet it closes in a week and disappears until it comes out on video. The film Ruby is a good example, and since it just came out on video, we thought we'd rebroadcast an interview with its star, Danny Aiello. Aiello plays Jack Ruby, the man who shot Lee Harvey Oswald. But the film doesn't obsessively work out a complex conspiracy theory like the movie JFK. Ruby is more of a character study of a man who is everybody's patsy, the mob, the cops, and the CIA. Danny Aiello also starred in Moonstruck, as Cher's intended, and in Do the Right Thing, as Sal, the owner of the pizzeria. He told me he remembers watching Ruby shoot Oswald live on TV.
I went, yip, yip, hooray. I believed at that time, Terry, in street justice, an eye for an eye. He killed our president, and this guy killed him. Good. That's how I felt. And this, of course, was the germ of the idea where I began to formulate the character of Ruby. I made him in my own mind a hero. And as we know, the way Ruby ends up, we find out that he's really not a hero, and he's realizing it toward the end of his life. But that was my reaction.
When did you stop thinking hip, hip, hooray?
Well, I still have a feeling about Ruby. I feel that he murdered this guy, but I truly feel that he was a victim as well of the kind of a person he was. He was a very ingratiating person. He was a chameleon kind of person. He was a person who brushed shoulders with many, many kinds of people. And whenever he did that, assuming that it was a wise guy, he would attempt to take on the persona of a wise guy. If he was on a stage introducing an act, he suddenly became Dale Carnegie with a southern twinge in his voice, therefore placating his audience. And if he was with an intellectual, he would become or attempt to become that kind of a person. He was a person that was looking for acceptance all of his life, I feel. And through my investigation of the character and a little that there was on Ruby, I formulated this kind of character, which I thought would be complex and very nice to do. He never left me. He has never left me. The word hero might not be the correct one, but he's never left me as a guy who did what he had to do. The reason, if I do call him a hero and feel that he was a hero, I don't know exactly when I stopped feeling that way. I don't know if I entirely have stopped feeling that way. But he was a guy who did something he felt, in my opinion, was patriotic. He did something which he felt was going to uplift his race of people, which are Jewish people. This is what I feel. He did something that he thought was heroic, only later to find out that people didn't think he was a hero. He thought they stole from the American people. He stole from the American people the opportunity of finding out what actually did happen. And as a result of that, they felt that he was a conspirator. And I think from that point on was when his downfall was, and he slowly died from then on.
You portray Ruby as a small-time guy who's gotten in over his head.
Absolutely.
And who often has to bluff his way out of tight situations. And you do wonderful line readings in the movie. I mean, I think you just convey a lot with your voice and with where you put the accents in certain readings of lines. I wonder how you rehearse these things, even at home. And I don't even necessarily mean on the set, but when you got this script and you were trying to figure out how you would do the character, how you would do specific lines, what's your process like for testing out your line reading?
I wish I had a process. I do it until I learn it. And I don't learn it, I'm talking about line by line by line. I don't memorize it to the extent where it's like rote. It's always got to be fresh and new to me. I like to go before the cameras knowing the lines, but I'm not totally sure of them. Do you follow what I mean? So that when they do come out of my mouth, they appear to be coming out of my mouth for the first time. I don't know what the system is. People at the American Academy asked me to come over and teach. I said, what am I going to teach? They said, the Aiello system. I said, what is that? I have no way of defining it. All I know is I sit by myself, with myself, I work on the script, and it's a matter of repetition, constantly going over the entire script, interrelating with other characters, what other characters mean to me. And then I find, after making all the plans that I can, when I'm finally going before the cameras opposite the other actor, things change. And they all start all over again, and it's probably nothing that I've been rehearsing. But I like to go in there with that feeling that I'm not quite sure what all the lines are, so that it comes out not like rote, as I said before.
Yeah, no, I understand. When you were shooting Ruby, how aware were you of JFK, of Oliver Stone's movie? And I wonder if Ruby was almost rushed out so it would get to screens in time to ride the crest of the assassination wave.
This is a very important question you're giving me, Terry, and I should have said this up front to you before I did, before we got into it. But Ruby was an idea long before JFK was thought of being made a motion picture. Ruby was a stage play written by Stephen Davis, who was the screenwriter of Love Field, which was the other title for Ruby, and we couldn't use Love Field because it was another motion picture. We had to use Ruby. It was on a stage in London before JFK was thought of being made. It was picked up by Propaganda Films. JFK, of course, was later being made. The script then came to my attention. We all decided to do it. We put it together. It happened to coincide with the last 2 weeks of their shooting was when we were beginning. We had no time rush to get it open. And I'll tell you why. I wanted to rush. I wanted to get it open at the same time JFK was open so that people had an alternative. Or they could see both and, you know, get what they will out of both. They couldn't rush it because they felt they had a good motion picture and they certainly didn't want it to appear as if we were trying to rip off JFK or the success of JFK.
Well, I should say that the assassination is really such a small part of the movie in a way.
It is, really. I think it's about relationships. And the thing that I love JFK, let me say, as a motion picture. You should know that. And I make my comparisons. I just feel that our film, it's a terrible thing to say, especially when you're in it and you're doing the lead in it, you're playing the title character. But I think our film's a more accessible film. I think the people are more real. I think they're smaller in stature, in size, and therefore gives you the opportunity to really get into the story of Ruby. In JFK, everyone appears to be bigger in life, even the way that they decided to cast it. They have 40 stars, named stars, playing minor roles, which is great, but we have wonderful actors, probably equally as wonderful, not as well known. We have faces in our film like it was a Fellini film. I mean, faces you haven't been seeing in 900 pictures. And many of those guys happen to be my friends.
Oh, really? Literally? They were cast because they were your friends?
Well, not because of that. Because ultimately, the decision was being made by Joanna Ray, who's the casting person from England. Wonderful.
But you
and
got
John McKenzie. But I wanted John to see these people. I said, John, instead of people that have been exposed so much in all the Scorsese films, the Coppola films, not that they're not great, but let's look brand new here. And I was happy that many of the decisions or suggestions were mine. I mean, they were just wonderful. I'm so proud of the job that they did. And let me tell you, they didn't work for the money they usually make. They make a lot more because we didn't have a $50 million movie. we had somewhere in the air of a $9 million movie.
Did you work for less than usual?
Well, they paid me a lot of money.
Right, okay.
No, I didn't work. On Do the Right Thing, I worked for less.
Right.
And because that was a very low-budgeted film.
Right.
This was a mediocre-budgeted film, somewhere in a $9 or $10 million right. area. And no, I worked for my money then, and they gave it to me. And I'm very happy about that, but I also feel that I worked very hard to depict a character which I hope the American public would find as somewhat sympathetic.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Danny Aiello, and he stars in the new movie, Ruby. You started acting when you were in your mid-30s. Did you have any idea before that you were even interested in acting?
No, I gravitated toward acting, Terry, because I thought it might be, it's a communication media, and I was a fairly good talker, and I was fairly good with people, that maybe this would be the way to go. I was uneducated. I was in high school for about a half hour. I went in one door and out the other. I went to James Monroe. So I really had no education, no trade. So I felt that the obvious place to go after losing the union job would be into acting, never realizing how difficult that profession is. But I did it anyway. But I never thought I would be a failure. I always thought to some level I would be a success if I dedicated myself. And look what happened, you know.
I'm interested in your early life. Your father was a teamster and was on the road a lot.
Yeah, my father was not home. We had what could be perceived as a fatherless home.
Right.
Amanda would come home once a year, impregnate my mother, have a steak while we all ate macaronis and beans. But Mama managed to find a steak for him somehow, and he ate it. He ate it very proudly at the table while we ate macaroni and beans. But it was my mother who was solely responsible for the bringing up of 7 children.
I know you went to work when you were very young, but I think you also got involved in robberies when you were pretty young,
too.
Yeah,
I did some crazy things. I had a fear, Terry, of being homeless, And I was early on, I don't know when I was put in my mind. I guess maybe if Mama decided to run off like Dad did, then the 7 kids would have been homeless. So I guess that was the germ of the idea in my mind. And as I grew up and I lost my union presidency job, and there was very little for me to, you know, I was making 190 here, then I was making nothing. I got frightened, and I thought I wasn't going to be able to keep a roof over the heads of my 4 children and my wife and myself. And I did things to compensate for that, and they were not armed robberies. They were not hitting people over the head. They were some maybe deserted buildings where there might be a safe. I did some silly, stupid things that I feel ashamed I did, and I hate to even talk about them in public because it sends out mixed signals. It's like the dope addict who says, look, you kids can don't start dope, you know, but he's telling a kid not to start dope when he was a dope addict and is now telling people he got off of it and he's a famous person, you know what I mean?
Yeah, I know exactly.
So I don't like to send out those messages, but the fact is that was my life. And I try to justify it by saying, you know, I was desperate, I thought we were going to be homeless, and that was the only way I can turn. Because at that point in my life, it was pretty hard for me to have no money coming in and supporting a family of 6. 4 children, my wife and I.
Did you make sure the statute of limitations was up before mentioning
it
publicly?
Yeah, as a matter of fact, I did. What a wise son of a gun I am, but I did. And, you know, I don't want you to think that it was like this was an ongoing thing forever. It was a thing that happened until the fear became so great in me that I said, I just can't do this, because what I would be doing is losing my family anyway if I did have to go in.
Mm-hmm.
And things, just as God wants, started to work out. See, I had the problem, I never wanted to borrow money from anyone. I wouldn't take money, I wouldn't ask, I wouldn't accept help from anyone. And the only help that I did accept was something that really set me off to stealing, and that was welfare. I didn't have the guts to go into the welfare office. My wife did. Twice on welfare for 2 months. My wife stood in line, humiliated, right? And she came from a family that had money. She was humiliated, and she stood there. And I swore I would never do that again. So when we started to get destitute again, I refused to go back there. So the next thing that I did was decide to make money in another way. Sandy had no idea I did it. She thought I was hustling pool again, because I was an expert pool shooter, billiard shooter at the early time of my life. So I was telling Sandy lies as to where I was getting the rent money, there were times that I was 4 or 5 months behind in my rent, and I was afraid we were going to be homeless again, so I would go out and do something, and I'd break into cigarette machines, jukeboxes. I used to pay rent with quarters and nickels and dimes. It's crazy, and I'm ashamed to tell you this, Terry, and I don't want you to think any less of me for it, but I'll tell you, people do that, and we can be critical and should be critical because no one should have to do that. But sometimes you get so desperate and you have no one to turn to ask the advice, and you go out and do it.
So what was the job that got you out of this?
Well, the acting started to come more and more, and I started bouncing in Roseland, and I took other bouncing jobs to supplement my earnings. Then, of course, the improvisation again. Then I began getting Broadway shows, acting jobs. Remember, the first acting jobs I got were on a stage, and they were off Broadway. They were so off, it was like in a Bronx somewhere. And they were paying very, very little money, if not any money at all, you know. They were like Equity Productions, 13 performances. The fortunate thing is a writer by the name of Louis LaRusso had written me 3 off-Broadway plays. And I gave back his audition, and each one of those plays, I took to Broadway and starred in each of them.
Actor Danny Aiello is my guest. His movie Ruby just came out on video. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. Actor Danny Aiello is my guest. You know, we were talking about bluffing. The way you play Jack Ruby, he has to bluff his way through a lot of situations. I'm wondering, when you started to act, did you have to bluff your way into acting? Did you have to make it seem like you really knew what you were doing, even though you had no experience?
Terry, I never studied one day in my life as an actor. I never went to school. I was a man in a hurry. I started at 35. I felt schooling at this point to learn how to act is not what I need. If I don't know how to get up there and recreate things that I've had or experienced on the street, then I have a serious problem. So I was a man in a hurry. The bluffing came where you had to lie, unfortunately, like most actors beginning do. They put on their resume, some phony resume, and because when you go in without a resume, you sit there with an agent. He said, what have you done? And you say, well, I haven't done anything yet. He said, well, I said, well, you get in what they call a catch-22. You can't get an agent unless you've done something. You can't get a job unless you have an agent. So what do? You know, somewhere along the line, someone has to believe that you can do it. Someone's got to be willing to give you that job.
What would you do at auditions to try to impress casting directors?
Well, auditions for me were horrific. I don't know that I've ever got a job in my life auditioning. I usually got my jobs talking head-to-head with the director. Right? He got to know about me, I got to know about him. But auditioning, even at this time, 7 years ago I decided I will never audition again. I will never put the power in anyone's hands and tell them they haven't got it, I have got it. I am a firm believer, if I was a director, there is not an actor in the world that I couldn't cast for a movie if I was directing it by simply sitting opposite him and talking to him and having a conversation and being able to decide at that moment that I can work with this man and I can get what I want on the screen from this man. Reading of roles and trying to be someone at a cold reading or even a prepared reading is never what a good actor ends up doing anyway.
Because it's so contrived?
All baloney.
Yeah.
All you're doing is teaching the director and those other people who was his hangarounds want to learn about the character.
You know, one of your really big breakthrough roles was as Sal in Do the Right Thing. And I really loved you in that film. And I always felt watching that movie that Spike Lee probably saw the character as a blatant racist, but that you gave the character a depth and integrity. And I know you actually even wrote lines for the character to flesh the character out. But it was as if, to me, it was as if Spike Lee didn't notice that the character had changed by virtue of your interpretation of it. And so in the meantime, all the plot was proceeding as if you were this one-dimensional racist, when in fact the character you were playing was no longer that.
Yeah, if you pick up his original script, the original, you'll see that he was a one-note character. To me, he was what I would have called in the old days a token black in an all-white film. In this case, he could have been a token white and all black film. When I looked at it, I told Spike, I said, this guy's a plantation owner. This guy's a boring character. Why is he there? Why is he in Bed-Stuy? Why has he got a pizzeria and in a totally black neighborhood? I said, he can be anywhere. So I defined in my own mind that he's there because that's where he wants to be. He likes the people. He enjoys the people he's working with. He saw them get older. He enjoys the fact that they love his food. He's that kind of a simple guy, and it was because of that, I think, that made the character a more sympathetic character, and they're a multi-dimension character, as opposed to a simple out-and-out racist. Now, you may define in your own mind or come to the conclusion that Sal is a racist, but it's not obvious.
But do you think that Spike Lee maybe didn't even notice how the character was changing? In other words, I always felt that the movie proceeded, the plot proceeded as if some of the people were acting to you like you were this just one-note racist, which the character no longer was.
Well, that may be the ability to people to either respond as actors or not be able to respond to what it is they're hearing. You know what I mean? With Spike, I have to give him this. Before I agreed to do this, I said I wanted to make some changes. He said, anything you want to do to make it better. That's what Spike said. And he went with the program as we were going. See, there was one part of the film at the end where it bothered me that Spike's character, Mookie, said to Sal, my character, what are you arguing about after the place was burned? Are you going to get your money back on insurance? I was infuriated by that remark because you cannot, as a store owner, as a business owner in Bed-Stuy, get insurance. So I said, this is a joke. Why are you saying that? I said, I want to come back. Well, what are you kidding? You? I couldn't get earthquake insurance in this neighborhood. He didn't want that line in. So I had to write this other line. This isn't about money. This is about I built this place with my bare hands. Do you remember that line? So he compromised somewhat. He didn't want me to say I couldn't get earthquake insurance in this neighborhood. But he did permit me to say, this isn't about money. This is about I built this place with my bare hands. Anything anyone ever tells me could never make me believe that Sal was an out-and-out racist. What Sal is a realist. If a man, forgive my language, or anyone who may be offended, looks at Sal and calls him a guinea, Sal will in kind come back and call you a nigger, a spick, a mick, a kite. Do you follow what I'm saying? He would go to the core of trying to hurt that person as that person just tried to hurt him. That's the honesty of Sal.
You're just joining us. My guest is Danny Aiello, and he stars in the new movie Ruby about Jack Ruby. I know one of the early jobs you had was working for Greyhound. You were the president of the union local there. You were an announcer for the buses.
Yes.
When was the last time you were at a Greyhound terminal?
I always stop by there, and I stop by there every so often just to recall the past, because there's so many things that are no longer vivid to me. Every house I ever lived in New York City, and I lived in about maybe 35 apartments, have all been torn down. There's not a place where I lived as a kid that I can identify as a place where I lived. So any place that has some history that I had something to do with, such as Greyhound, I like to go back to. I haven't spoken to anyone. I don't know too many of the people there. Of course, that was in 1967 that I lost that job. I would just go back to look and remember that this is where I was.
Danny Aiello, he stars in the movie Ruby, which just came out on video. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio. We'll be right back.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, the star of the comedy series Rock, Charles Dutton. Dutton starred on Broadway and appeared in films, but he got his start acting while serving a prison sentence for manslaughter. Also, Stephen Schiff reviews Mo Money, the new movie starring Damon Wayans of In Living Color. Wayans also wrote the screenplay. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. Officials of the Bush administration kept up the military pressure on Iraq today by sending a third aircraft carrier to the Middle East. This announcement came as 9 U.N. inspectors prepared to leave for Baghdad. Yesterday, the head of a U.N. special commission announced a compromise with Iraqi officials to inspect a government building believed to house important documents on Iraq's banned weapons systems. NPR's Deborah Amos reports.
The USS Kennedy ended a port visit early to head for the Middle East today. In addition, the Bush administration announced that Patriot missiles are being sent to Kuwait. The Patriot missiles were the somewhat effective counter to Iraqi Scud missiles during the Desert Storm campaign. At the same time, a State Department spokesman said it was not enough for Iraq to allow the inspection of an agriculture building in Baghdad, giving the impression that the current standoff is far from over. The signals from the Bush administration have moved Saddam to prepare for a possible showdown. According to military observers, Iraqi troop movements in the north of the country suggest that Saddam is concerned that his opponents in the north will seize the initiative in the confusion of an American airstrike. In Washington, this is Deborah Amos.
Democratic presidential candidate Bill Clinton spoke before the National Urban League convention today and accused the Bush administration of neglecting housing, jobs, and other concerns. Speaking this morning in San Diego, Clinton said that President Bush responded with housing programs only in the face of a crisis. Clinton said that Republican officials, in their eagerness to prove that they have done nothing wrong, will try to make this year's election liberal versus conservative and left versus right. Georgia's Secretary of State has ordered a recount in the Republican primary race involving House Minority Whip Newt Gingrich. James Argroves of Peach State Public Radio reports.
Election officials in Georgia will start recounting ballots tomorrow in the race between Gingrich and challenger Herman Clark. Gingrich defeated Clark by fewer than 1,000 votes, and Clark immediately asked for a recount, claiming there were voting irregularities in the race. Clark said today he requested the recount because he isn't sure the voters in the district received a fair and impartial election. Gingrich could not be immediately reached for comment. Although he was officially the incumbent in last week's primary, it was Gingrich's first race in the new district. For National Public Radio, I'm James Argroves in Atlanta.
General Motors and Hughes Aircraft have announced plans to help in the rebuilding of inner cities of Los Angeles hit hard by rioting. The two companies have pledged some $18 million over the next 5 years. Last week, a supermarket chain promised up to $100 million to build as many as a dozen new stores in riot-hit areas. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down more than 3 points to close at 3,282.20. This is NPR News. In Bosnia, UN officials say that they will try an airdrop of food and medicine to thousands of Muslim refugees stranded in a town about 30 miles from Sarajevo. Efforts to get to the region by land have failed. Residents of the town have been stranded for almost 3 months, and there are reports of heavy casualties and shortages of food and medical supplies. Factional fighting in Bosnia has forced nearly one-third of the area's residents out of their homes. Some estimates have the number of people killed at more than 40,000. Campaigning today in Appleton, Wisconsin, President Bush gave a green light to the state for yet another experimental welfare program. Beth Graham of member station WUWM reports.
Bush told a Central Wisconsin rally that he's given approval to the state's proposed two-tier welfare plan. Under that plan, aid to new residents to Wisconsin would be no more than what they received in the state they moved from. Welfare payments would rise to full state resident level after 6 months. The plan was developed amidst concerns Wisconsin is becoming a welfare magnet, paying as much as $250 a month more to a family of three than neighboring states. Opponents to the two-tier plan say it's unconstitutional, and the state Supreme Court must review it before it can be implemented. In Appleton, the president today urged other states to follow Wisconsin's lead in welfare reforms. For National Public Radio, I'm Beth Graham in Milwaukee.
Vice President Dan Quayle says any talk about ousting him from the GOP ticket is past history. Quayle says that he has talked a lot about the campaign with President Bush, and any question about dumping the number two man in the ticket is a closed issue. A new poll by Newsweek found that 56% of those surveyed gave Quayle an unfavorable rating. 49% in a Times CNN poll said that Quayle should be replaced on the GOP ticket. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. In August, the Fox TV series Rock returns with live episodes. They tried a live episode last season, and it was very effective. Just before that broadcast, I spoke with the star of Rock, Charles Dutton. Rock is a comedy series about a working-class black family. Rock is a garbage collector. His wife is a nurse. Rock's cranky father and unemployed brother live in Rock's house.
Quality engineer. Foreman.
Am I dreaming or are you actually reading the one ads?
Yep.
You're reading the one ads?
No, you're dreaming. Working a crossword puzzle. I need an eight-letter word for quality engineer.
Employed.
Looking at those one ads is a waste of time. All the jobs are there for white people.
What pop you or if
That's
you...
right. Here. Look at this one. Hotel seeks hands-on person with professional appearance and effective communication skills to handle customer relations.
Yeah, so it's an ad for a hotel manager.
If you're white, it is. If you're black, it's for a doorman.
Doesn't sound like a good career move, right?
Charles Dutton came to TV from the stage. He received Tony nominations for his performances in The Piano Lesson and Ma Rainey's Black Bottom. He's in the film Aliens 3 and co-stars with Denzel Washington in Mississippi Masala. Dutton is a graduate of Yale Drama School, but you could say his real alma mater is the Maryland State Penitentiary, where he spent 7.5 years. He was sent to prison in 1968 for manslaughter. A little later, we'll hear how Dutton discovered his gift for acting while he was behind bars. First, let's find out how he got to where he is right now. Rock was built around him, but Dutton says he resisted the idea for about 2 years.
I didn't have any desire to do television at all. Stage is and was my first love. And I had a film career staring me right in the face at the time. So after many discussions on about the style of the show, I just never imagined myself, I didn't want to wind up doing a silly kind of sitcom. So basically, they made me an offer I couldn't refuse, and once the creative aspects of the show was agreed upon and a style of the show was agreed upon to my satisfaction, I set the wheels in motion to do it. And things developed from there, you know.
Did you model the character of Rock on anyone who you know or knew?
No one in particular. This show germinated originally as to be the Black Honeymooners. And with me as the Gleason character and someone else as the Norton character. During many creative discussions, we decided at that time that we would find our own niche and do our own thing. And the character went from, the Gleason bus driver kind of thing, to finding his own occupation, and we selected a garbage man, and it took shape from there. You know, the close cropped haircut that I used for the character.
Wait a minute, you have a shaved head, not a close cropped haircut.
Well, right, you're right. Sometimes I let 2-3 days growth grow on it. Like last episode we taped, I had a little hair, But that wasn't necessarily a fixture for the character. That actually came from the movie Aliens 3 that I had just completed before we shot the pilot episode of Rock. And so once I saw tape of the pilot, I had decided that I liked the look. Although this summer I can't wait to grow my hair back, but for the character, I like it.
And when I saw you in Mississippi Marcel, it took me a second to recognize you because of the hair.
Yeah.
Now, I know you want the series to really ring true. I have to mention here that the writer, Stan Daniels, is white, and I wonder if you ever feel that there are things that don't ring true that you want to change because the writer is a white person writing about a black family.
Sure. No, I understand that. It's, Stan Daniels is white, and Stan doesn't write all the scripts. We have three black writers out of seven. We have a black full-time director. We have four black actors, and as far as I'm concerned, nothing goes past me without some kind of sanctioning, whether it's a script or a storyline or whatever. Now, the problem with that is, of course, you're going to have white writers who don't know one iota about a black family life. And sometimes I think that can be a fault of white television writers, you know, who may be writing for a series that's set in the East Coast, which they know nothing about, but yet they won't even venture into South Central Los Angeles in broad daylight just to drive by it or drive through it just to see and experience what it may look like.
Charles Dutton is my guest. He's the star of Rock on Fox TV. We're going to take a short break, then talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Actor Charles Dutton is my guest, the star of the series Rock. You've had, as you know, a very extraordinary life. You spent several years in prison and went to reform school as a kid. And you once described it as a great place for an inner city kid to get to play in the country or something along those lines.
What
did you find to like about reform school?
Well, growing up in the inner city of Baltimore, you didn't get out as a kid. You didn't get out to sort of enjoy the outdoors, I grew up in a housing project. Occasionally you may go to summer camp if your folks could afford it, or if it was a free summer camp, once 1 week or 2 weeks in the summer. But when you went to reform school, you were, in a rural area in the country, where there were, animals, livestock, and organized sports, and three meals a day, and two movies a week, and so to me, it was fun. To me, going to reform school was fun. Me and my buddies would actually organize our juvenile activities, so that we went to court in early April or May, just to spend 3 or 4 months in reform school.
It's like your version of summer camp.
It was a version of summer camp. It really was. And all your friends were there, but what you don't realize as 11, 12, 13-year-old kid, that you're actually being conditioned at an early age to become a ward of the state. So that by the time you leave reform school, you're ready for the next level.
Prison.
Say if 13 or 14, there's always one more reform school stop, and that's 15 to 16-year reform school. But that's the middle one, and it gets tougher each time. But then you're ready for the next level because it's like the floodgates open, and your friends go to the next level, and then you go to the next level, and after that, you know, you're ready for the big leagues, and that is prison, you know.
Would you explain the story of how you got to prison?
When I was 17, I killed a guy in a fight. He nearly killed me, and I wrestled a knife from him, and I killed him. See, I lived and he died. That was a long, long time ago, nearly 23, 24 years ago. I did 2 years for manslaughter, and I was released, and then I went right back to prison a couple months later for possession of deadly weapons. I was convicted and sentenced to 3 years in prison, and while doing the 3 years in prison, I got into a fight with a correctional officer in the prison and was sentenced to an additional 8 years sentence. So they structured the sentencing, whereas I had to do the 3 year sentence first and then start on the 8 year sentence. So, you know, during that time, after I went back to prison the second time, I was what I consider a total knucklehead. You know, I was anti-authority. I had no respect for authority. I was a radical militant. You know, I really believed that there was going to be an armed overthrow of the United States government, and I was willing to die for that. You know, I was in the Black Panther Party. I was in one of the toughest prisons in the country at that time.
This is in Maryland?
In Maryland, Maryland State Penitentiary. It ranked in the top five of the toughest prisons in the country at that time. I never considered myself a vicious person. I never considered myself a person who did anything premeditatedly. The incident of the manslaughter charge was a situation where I was 17 years old. And it was just at a party, and a fight broke out, and me and this guy had a nice fight going on, and he pulled a knife and stabbed me several times. I wrestled it away from him and stabbed him.
What was your identity in prison before you became known as the actor and the one who organized the theater group? Who were you before?
Well, I was a troublemaker. Yeah. I was on the prison administration's hit list. I was beat up, brutalized by the guards, prison guards, more than once in those 7.5 years that I spent. I had my ribs broken, my nose broke, an ankle cracked, 2 fingers broke. I had my head bust 6-7 different times in prison. I had my teeth knocked out. I had my eye lacerated with 22 stitches. Across my eyebrow.
This is all by guards?
Over the course of time. All by prison guards, yeah. I got in a lot of fights in prison, too, with inmates. But once I became politically conscious, the inmate against inmate fighting stopped for me, at least. When I was in my, street stage, mentally, I got in fights with other inmates. But when I started to read in prison, admittedly, I was reading strictly leftist literature, Mao Zedong, Marx and Engels, Lenin. It was through the reading of politics and societies and capitalism and socialism and what makes the world tick, you know, in economically, you know, that I began to understand what my condition was and what these people around me conditions were. And so inadvertently, I began to discover my own humanity by being a radical.
Let me ask you how you got from reading mostly leftist literature to reading plays and getting interested in performing.
Well, in 1972, a girlfriend sent me an anthology of black playwrights. At the time, I had no intention. I thought this decadent, capitalistic cultural exercise. I want nothing to do with it. And the book sat on my shelf in my prison for 4 or 5 months. And finally, I got in a little trouble in prison with a guard, and I was sentenced to six days in isolation, which is a little room with no light, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. You were allowed one book to take. And I just reached back and grabbed the book, and I happened to pick that one up, and I read the book from cover to cover by the light that seeped under the door of the room. And it was a light shining in the hallway, and I just would lay down on my stomach at the door, and from the crack of the door, light, and turn the pages of the book and got a little light to read from. And I was struck by one play that was so hilarious, a satire, a political satire called Day of Absence by Douglas Turner Ward. After reading this play, I had determined that when I got out of isolation, I was going to get the funniest characters in the prison that I knew and get these guys together and form a drama group. And we would put this particular play on at the prison talent show. And I got out of isolation on the sixth day, and I showed this play to a couple of guys. A couple of guys couldn't read, so I told them what the play was about. And the prison talent show came along, and it was a school teacher in the prison who was a local actress, a lady by the name of Diane Weaver. And so Mrs. Weaver, she supervised the group, and we started this drama group, and it changed my life.
Have you ever worried about ending up back in prison, or do you think that that's just out of the question?
Well, I mean, I don't plan to do anything to get me back there. There is nothing that anyone can tell me about prison anymore. I have a PhD in prison life, you know. So there's no reason for me to go back. I don't hang out in the same circles. I'm not in the same company of guys who go in and out. I still have lots of friends who are in prison. They'll be my friends for as long as I'm on this planet. Guys on the street corners in Baltimore, you know, guys who are still using drugs, selling drugs, shooting drugs, and those people will always be my friends, you know. I'm hoping and praying that the ones who are involved in the negative things will eventually retire from it and see their lives in a different light and say, okay, I've had enough. You know, but if they don't, I can't be the one to judge.
Charles Dutton stars in the Fox TV series Rock. When Rock's new season begins on August 16th, the programs will be broadcast live. This is Fresh Air. Noah Adams is with us. Noah, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Hi, Terry. Brenda Wilson reports tonight on programs designed to stop the spread of AIDS in this country, education programs, especially in the schools, that are often quite explicit about sexual acts, and sometimes the attempts to be explicit could come into conflict with community values. NPR's Deborah Amos will review the developments over the weekend regarding the standoff between Iraq's Saddam Hussein and United Nations inspectors. And Linda Wertheimer goes to a food show, a national food show here in Washington, to report on farmhouse cheeses and smoked trout from Virginia, and also Jole Mole from Santa Fe, New Mexico.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Damon Wayans of TV's In Living Color has been in the movies for quite a while. He co-starred with Bruce Willis in The Last Boy Scout, and before that he was in Roxanne, Punchline, I'm Gonna Get You Sucka, and Hollywood Shuffle. His new movie takes him several steps further. He not only stars in it, he wrote and produced it as well. Film critic Stephen Schiff has a review of Mo Money.
What's surprising about Mo Money is Damon Wayans' ambition. Not that the movie has any sweep or grandeur or concern for the big issues. No, Wayans is ambitious in a different way. I expected him to be trying for the mantle of Richard Pryor, who parlayed his comic brilliance on stage into a decent, if unspectacular, movie career. But Mo Money isn't a comedy. It's really a violent action picture with comic overtones, like Beverly Hills Cop. In other words, Wayans wants the mantle of the admittedly declining Big Kahuna himself, Eddie Murphy. Fat chance. Wayans does have some of Murphy's comic versatility. He can do lots of voices and lots of characters, and he can be effeminate and then macho, silly and then super cool in the blink of an eye. But in repose, between shticks, Murphy is still magnetic and appealing. Wayans, meanwhile, turns slit-eyed and distanced, and a little bit creepy. Besides which, his comedy writing is not quite ready for the big time. Take this scene, for instance, in which Johnny, the street hustler Wayans plays, is selling children's books on the avenues of Chicago and finds himself face-to-face with a beautiful customer, played by Stacey Dash.
Excuse me. How much is this book?
For you? Free. Take it.
Nothing in America is free.
Love is.
Oh, really?
Besides, I think your kid will like it.
I don't have a kid.
Yes, Lord. Give him my $2.
What happened to free?
It's America, remember?
This is a great book. You should read it sometime.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Yeah, could I read it to you now? Let me see. The Ice Cream Dream. Wonder what that's about. I wish I had an ice cream. It'll look just like you. Sweet tasting chocolate, good all the way through. I'd lick it slow from head to toe.
You're fresh. I'll take my book before it melts, thank you.
Come again. And again.
That's about as hilarious as Mo Money gets. It's a crude, dispiriting movie, whose humor is often as brutal as its action scenes. The plot follows Wayans as he follows the woman in the book-selling scene. Her name is Amber, and she works for a big credit card company where Wayans finds a job in the mailroom. There, he involuntarily gets caught up in a scam run by the company's white security chief, all of which is supposed to strike us as tragically ironic. He escapes the life of a petty con man, only to find himself in the midst of a much bigger, more dangerous con. The movie's worldview is strangely unpleasant. Poor black men are hustlers and thieves. Well-to-do black men, like the executive Amber's dating, are insufferably prissy. White men are either victims to be fleeced or monsters who will destroy anything in their paths. Women are either beautiful and therefore to be captured, or not beautiful and therefore to be mocked mercilessly at every opportunity. The director, Peter MacDonald, has only one other movie to his credit, Rambo 3, which by comparison looks like Smiles of a Summer Night. Two exceptions to the general awfulness of it all. In Mo Money, yet another Wayans weighs in, 19-year-old Marlon, and he's lithe and funny and very attractive. Then there's the soundtrack, put together by Jimmy Jam and Terry Lewis, and full of hot, catchy tunes, all of which I'm sure would sound a lot better with the movie out of the way. My financial advice? Invest in the CD. This is a case when Mo is less.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for Vanity Fair. I'm Terry Gross.
When you whack, sometimes you swat, and when you swat, you're gonna get away.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by this and other NPR member stations. Additional support comes from the George Gund Foundation. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we're live from New York, from the studio of the Museum of Television and Radio. Jazz guitarist Bucky Pizzarelli will perform, and we'll talk with George C. Wolfe, the writer and director of the Broadway hit musical about Jelly Roll Morton, Jelly's Last Jam. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.